This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
I'm Audie Cornish. And forgive us for getting this music stuck in your head. Friends, Seinfeld, ER, the ultimate lineup for NBC television, it was branded as must-see TV. At the time, the network was so flush with cash, they were able to make this offer to the star of their hit comedy.
When we went to Jerry Seinfeld and said, Jerry, we love you, the audience loves you, and we want you to come back for yet another year. Well, we put over $100 million on the table just to Jerry, and he was able to say no.
That is crazy.
Yeah.
Warren Littlefield should know. He was the president of NBC Entertainment at the time. He tells this story and others in a new book called Top of the Rock, Inside the Rise and Fall of Must-See TV.
At the heart of the great years of Must-See TV, we were driving $1 billion into the bottom line for profitability a year. And today, a successful network is looking at a few hundred million dollars.
Littlefield has left the network, but is still in the TV development game. And he sees NBC struggling to recapture that magic of must-see TV.
Audiences want and need a shared viewing experience. And what must-see TV was all about was one network, one night for one decade. And a third of the country would come and watch must-see TV. And you didn't dare go to work the next day because if you hadn't watched, you would be left out of the conversation, that water cooler conversation, that connection.
And of course, now you don't need to do that, right? If someone tells you about a show, you can go, oh, I'll go check my DVR or I'll go online and watch it all at once.
Yes, you watch it on your terms when you want to watch it. And then I think the audience still has that need for participation, for a shared experience. Live entertainment events can still bring the nation together, but we lose some of that massive collective experience. And that will never come back. And part of the
celebration.
But is
that really true? I mean, when I'm watching the Oscars and everyone is on Twitter talking about it or having a conversation on Facebook about it, I do feel like I'm having a communal experience with the show. In some cases, enjoying it more, you know, because you're having the water cooler conversation at that moment.
Absolutely. I agree with that. But that's live event television. I think the difference is we did it every single week where a third of the country was watching.
Now, in one part of the book, you have another former CEO of NBC, Bob Wright, and he says it's easy to go narrow, but it's hard to stay broad and attractive. That's why the failure rate is so high, talking about creating programming. And it seems, though, that the opposite is true now. It seems as though narrow programming is the future. Everyone will get to watch their own channel with programming that they want to see.
Well, 200 channel choices in most homes certainly gives you the world of choice. And so slicing it, dicing it, and offering someone their favorite thing. By the way, if it's not good enough, make it yourself and post it. But I think what audiences covet really are the high quality. Look at the incredible production of Game of Thrones. Look at what that does.
And that's a program, a fantasy show on HBO.
Absolutely. And the production values are magnificent, huge cast, and wonderful storytelling. Now, in a network world, that still may not survive. Network is still looking for a larger tent, still looking to find something like a Modern Family that appeals to adults and kids, audiences of all ages. That's still at nearly 20 million people a week. That's a pretty broad-based hit that really far exceeds what's being watched on cable.
At the same time, you know, if you look at the numbers this quarter for the networks, ABC lost 21% of its average viewing audience. I mean, this is in the last 4 weeks. NBC also lost percentage. Fox lost 20%. It just seems as though with the shift where the eyeballs are going, people watching it on their own, I'm wondering how you still have that same creative process in development if there's this kind of fleeting paycheck.
It's smaller and smaller, and it will never be what must-see TV was.
Could there ever be a must-see TV? You could make the greatest programming in the world, but can you ever recreate that kind of draw in this environment?
Not that size and not that magnitude. It's different. Our DVRs make up the schedule of the shows that we're passionate about. You want Jon Stewart? You've got it. Your DVR will give that to you, as opposed to making the destination and the choice to spend that evening with a network.
Warren, I have to ask, I've always wondered how the network that gave us The Cosby Show could go on to a period that was so lacking in diversity. And I really enjoyed must-see TV. I watch Seinfeld, I watch Friends, all these things. But it felt like a step back in a way in terms of images that you saw on TV culturally.
I think when you look at the comedies of must-see TV, you're absolutely right. ER, Homicide, Life on the Street, Law and Order, those dramas absolutely had diversity throughout their cast.
It did, and that's why it seemed like possible, but it just was so weird. Like, the takeaway from, like, the most successful family comedy ever was, we're not doing that again. Is that what happened?
No, not at all. Cosby's decline was somewhat accelerated when Fox put The Simpsons up against us, and we were in trouble. I had lots of arm wrestling battles trying to add some diversity. And in the comedies, I just wasn't as successful. Just because you're the network president doesn't mean you can get everything you want. And I'm far more proud of the diversity in drama in terms of meeting that goal.
Well, thank you for answering the question. It was this sort of, as a TV watcher, it's something I've always wondered.
Without a doubt. Yes, of course.
Warren Littlefield, he's the former head of entertainment for NBC, and he's currently in charge of The Littlefield Company, a television production firm. Warren, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Thank you, Audie.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
The BBC drama series Sherlock returns for a second season Sunday on PBS. Our critic at large, John Powers, has been thinking about why the character of Sherlock Holmes continues to fascinate us.
One of my favorite professors, the late Ian Watt, taught that there were four great myths of modern individualism: Faust, Don Juan, Don Quixote, and Robinson Crusoe. This always got me wondering which, if any, pop culture heroes might endure in the same way. James Bond? Luke Skywalker? The Avengers? Come on. In fact, there's only one who I feel sure will last. Sherlock Holmes. In the 125 years since Arthur Conan Doyle created the world's greatest detective, 75 different actors have played him in the movies, and scads more on TV, not to mention the countless knockoffs like The Mentalist or Mr. Spock, who once claimed Holmes as his ancestor. We've had him as a teen and young Sherlock Holmes, a wisecracking action star played by Robert Downey Jr., and a retired beekeeper in Michael Chabon's terrific little novel, The Final Solution, where he encounters the crime of the century, the Holocaust. Now he's been updated as a present-day Londoner in Sherlock, the British TV series which offers the best version of Holmes and Dr. Watson I've ever seen. The obvious reason for Holmes's enduring appeal is that, while he possesses no superpowers, his parents weren't wizards, no radioactive spider bit him, his gifts are cool enough to be superhuman. Playing to fantasies of being smarter than everyone else, Holmes performs jaw-dropping feats of perception, like this one in the first episode of Sherlock. Martin Freeman's Dr. Watson has known Holmes all of 90 seconds when Sherlock, played by Benedict Cumberbatch, talks about renting a flat together and gives Watson a taste of just who, or maybe what, he's dealing with.
Is that it?
Is that what?
We only just met. We're going to go look at a flat. We don't know a thing about each other. I don't know where we're meeting. I don't even know your name.
I know you're an army doctor and you've been invalided home from Afghanistan. I know you've got a brother who's worried about you, but you won't go to him for help because you don't approve of him, possibly because he's an alcoholic, more likely because he recently walked out on his wife. And I know that your therapist thinks you're limp psychosomatic quite correctly, I'm afraid. It's enough to be going on with, don't you think? The name's Sherlock Holmes and the address is 221B Baker Street. Afternoon.
As you can tell, this Holmes is a bit of a showman, one who feels sure that he ought to be mythic. He's right. Like all mythic figures, Sherlock embodies an archetypal aspect of the human psyche. In his case, the power of rational thought. I am a brain, he tells Watson in one story. The rest of me is mere appendix. And as a brain, he's the embodiment of the scientific mind. A relentless empiricist, he not only notices details that ordinary folks don't, but he treats all of reality, from tobacco ashes to a dog that doesn't bark, as a collection of clues. He puts these clues together to solve baffling crimes, which can involve a pygmy murderer, a poisonous snake, or a gigantic hound. Now, lasting mythic heroes tend to emerge during periods of psychosocial tumult, when old values are being threatened by new ones. Holmes came to life in 1887, during the waning years of a Victorian era in which everything from the traditional social order to the belief in God was being subverted. It's no accident that this same period produced three other literary creations who spoke to a sense of chaotic darkness bubbling beneath the surface of things. The blood-drinking Dracula, the murderously schizoid Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and of course Peter Pan, who refused to grow up into the complicated world of adulthood. Their mythic power still persists, but mainly as metaphors, like the Peter Pan complex, or in the welter of hip vampires roaming our pop culture. Sherlock remains Sherlock. Of course, darkness bubbles in Holmes's world, too. If he lacks the tragic dimension of Faust, a fellow thinking machine, but one with ambitions so grand they damn him, he's not a cipher like 007 or Hercule Poirot. His monomaniacal genius borders on sociopathy. It cuts him off from humanity. He has but one friend, Watson, his Sancho Panza, an our surrogate, and but one great love, Irene Adler, whose appearance opens season two of Sherlock with a bang. When he's not solving crimes, boredom and melancholy lead Holmes to the violin, or cocaine. Yet if Holmes's desire for oblivion hints at the lonely man lurking beneath the brilliant Superman, it remains less potent than his sheer joy in asserting rational control over purveyors of chaos, like his archenemy, Professor Moriarty. Detective stories are all about learning the truth and restoring order. That's their power. And for Holmes, that's also their fun. Indeed, one reason why Sherlock still feels so fresh is his pleasure in the chase. Never dull or moralistic, he embodies that part of us that's turned on by a mystery, who, when he hears of a murder, feels that special tingle and cries, "Come, Watson, come. The game is afoot."
John Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. The second season of Sherlock premieres Sunday on PBS's Masterpiece Mystery. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air and on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com.
Information that could ruin the British monarchy locked in a smartphone. A crime scene surveyed through the camera of a laptop and a blogging Dr. Watson.
People want to know you're human.
Why?
Because they're interested.
No, they're not.
Why are they?
Look at that. 1,895.
Sorry, what?
I reset that counter last night. This blog has had nearly 2,000 hits in the last 8 hours. This is your living, Sherlock.
Actor Benedict Cumberbatch plays a very modern Sherlock Holmes in the BBC series Sherlock. The first season aired in the United States 2 years ago, and now Sherlock Series 2 begins on PBS this Sunday. Cumberbatch hopes it's a chance for more Americans to discover it.
And I just want to bring people in a little bit to that idea of sitting down on a Sunday three consecutive weeks and having that water cooler moment that really was a sort of national sensation in the UK, because it's kind of fun and it was an extraordinary cultural moment.
His work in Sherlock has led him to roles in Oscar-nominated films Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, and War Horse, and he'll be appearing in Peter Jackson's The Hobbit, among other high-profile projects. Both of Benedict Cumberbatch's parents are actors, but for the actor, it took leaving the stage to rediscover his passion. Did you ever think, like, God, I was just destined to do this, but maybe maybe I'd rather be a lawyer?
That was exactly what I wanted to be for a while. I mean, my mum and dad worked incredibly hard to afford me an education where I had the privilege of being able to choose or at least have the opportunity to work at being anything but an actor. They were living proof of the vagaries of the profession, and while they've triumphed and made a living out of it, which is a miracle considering the percentage of people who aren't employed in our profession. And as I was learning to be a barrister and sort of choosing my A-levels around potentially doing Oxbridge and doing law conversion courses, I just encountered loads of other people on the same course who said it's so much down to chance and luck. And I thought, well, why am I giving up on my primary dream to work doubly hard to do something as an alternative to what I really still want to do?
Was there a moment of a performance that really you look back on and just brought you back?
Well, there was a moment of extraordinary humbleness and humility and pride as well with my father when he turned to me. I think it was after I'd played Salieri in Amadeus at university, and he said, you're better than I ever was or ever could be. You should do this for a profession. You'd have a good time. And that's a huge thing for a man to say to his son, and not necessarily true, I might add. He's a wonderful actor himself, but it was so encouraging and supportive, and I knew then that they felt confident enough that I'd have a good ride. So I think that was sort of an emotional turning point, I guess. It was always important to have their blessing, and one of the reasons I get up in the morning is to make them proud.
You have spoken in the past about feeling like you yourself share some qualities with the character Sherlock Holmes.
I'm not nearly as smart as him, and I'm not as sociopathic, but there are just moments where I think I, like him, can cut off consideration for taking other people with me rather than just expecting them to be mind readers.
I wondered if you ever have to work on getting out of character. I mean, you're sitting there in our studio in New York. I mean, do you walk in there and look for shoelace fibers, fingerprints on the keyboard?
Yeah, I'm casting my eye around. It's quite a neat little studio you've got here. The cleaner's obviously been in the night before. I don't think many people have been in there. So what am I looking at? Microphone. Yeah, it's hard. It's hard. I'm really not Sherlock Holmes. I look a little bit like him and sound like him. But
the British press has really played up this idea of from Baker Street to Hollywood. Is that a thing? I mean, is that a transition that's been tough, extraordinary in some way?
No. It's just like most press narratives. That is much more interesting to read that, somebody sold his soul to the devil and is taking the golden handshake and gone off to Hollywood and has abandoned his homeland, which immediately happened the minute I stepped foot in LA to film Star Trek, which is kind of tiresome, but people still think it sells papers. And I think we're living in an era, especially in the British media, where there's an awful lot of soul searching that should be done at this stage, what with the Levinson inquiry and Murdoch being held out to task and just being exposed for the fraudulent, pathetic, abhorrent behavior that is rife in all of our media. I mean, he's being fingered, but the blame could be spread a lot wider. But, people always want to knock you when you're up, so it's fine. I can take the rough with this move, but it's kind of disappointingly predictable, I think, is what I'm trying to say through this rant.
The J.J. Abrams project, the new Star Trek sequel, I understand that you auditioned for that on an iPhone.
I did. Well, my best friend, Adam Ackland, and his wife, Alice, basically helped me out. I was in a bit of a corner. I couldn't get any casting directors because of that little Judeo-Christian cult that we call Christmas. And I had to do it on my iPhone. And they recorded me in their kitchen at about 11 o'clock.
Just like recording video on
exactly, iPhone. Exactly. I mean, it was kind of romantic. I mean, we are in a modern age where that is feasible, but I think it's one of the first I've heard of actually getting the role that way. But
the modern day of mailing in auditions, I guess.
Exactly. It was not exactly cold calling because it was asked for. And JJ was like, you did that on your iPhone? It was great. He was very complimentary about it. But I owe it to Adam and Alice for taking the time with their two kids who were asleep in the background somewhere in their bedrooms. And every night again we'd stop because we thought we heard one of them wake up. And it was really sweet, and it was lovely for them to be a part of it.
Smaug the Dragon is going to be your character in Peter Jackson's The Hobbit.
And the Necromancer as well, which was great fun to do.
Can you give us a little Smaug the Dragon? I mean, have you... Where
oh, God,
are you
no. No, I can't do that. That's looking behind the curtain. That's one that's coming up.
A little different than Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, a little different.
Is there definitely going to be a season three? Is that in the works?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it really depends what happens at the end of the three that we're about to see.
You can break news here. It's okay. We're fine with that if you want to tell
us. Oh, are you? That's good to know.
Yeah, just, you know.
Here's some breaking
let
news.
Let me know.
My coffee's lovely.
Excellent. That's what we do. We try our best. Actor Benedict Cumberbatch, you can see him as Sherlock Holmes in Sherlock Series 2, which is starting this Sunday on Masterpiece Mystery on PBS. Benedict, thanks so much for spending time with us.
An absolute pleasure, David. Thank you.
From NPR News, this is Morning Edition. The engineering supervisor is Kevin Langley. Our technical director is Kurt Stoniker. Audio engineers include Brian Jarbo, Vince Muse, Stacey Abbott, Greg Gavin, and Bill Plummer. Our executive producer is Madalika Sika. The executive editor of news programming is Ellen McDonald. Morning Edition's theme music was written by BJ Lederman and arranged by Jim Pugh. Our show is directed by Van Williamson, who we are saying goodbye to this morning. He is retiring after 18 years at NPR, most of them right here as Morning Edition's director. Van is a few feet away from me right now coordinating this broadcast. As all of us at NPR know, Van is a colleague you are instantly drawn to, unflappable under pressure. His smile and good nature just melt away the stress of the day. Morning Edition's Stephen Skeep sends this note. Van's a pro. It's a tribute to his seamless work that when we covered breaking stories, most listeners never heard any sign of the frantic work behind the scenes. Many people did notice another part of Van's work. He chose the music for this program, and we are hearing one of his final selections right now. Van, we wish you the best. I'm David Green.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we wrap up our week-long celebration of our fifth anniversary on the air with a final conversation about what's fun about being five. That's just ahead. But first, we want to tell you about a very funny and poignant film about people at the other end of lifespan, retirement. Now, retirement has generally not been the most amusing subject, especially in recent years when many seniors in the U.S. and in countries around the world have seen their savings vanish for various reasons. What to do when they still have many years ahead? The movie, The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, which opens in select cities today, follows a group of British senior citizens who travel to India, hoping to spend their retirement years in an inexpensive but luxurious hotel, only to find that their new home is not exactly the palace they envisioned. Once they arrive, they are welcomed by Sunny, the young hotel manager, played by Dev Patel, who previously starred in the Oscar-winning film Slumdog Millionaire.
Gentle friends, you have found your way to this place bequeathed to me by my beloved father, that I have raised from the ruins of his broken dreams and renamed the Best Exotic Marigold Hotel for the elderly and beautiful. Who knows how many days you have left? But we are most honored that you have chosen to spend that time with us.
And actor Dev Patel joins us now. Not the most delicate welcome, but...
I know. Rather aggressive.
But
it's
charming.
So weird when you hear your performance and, you know, the visuals are stripped away and you just hear your voice and the sound. It's crazy.
So let's talk about the film. First of all, what drew you to this?
You know, after Slumdog, I get sent so many scripts that are, you know, Indian-centric. And, you know, I try to be selective to avoid being typecast, number one. But number two, because I want to tell the right stories. And, you know, India is just a wealth of amazing stories. And I found that out when I was there. And I was utterly inspired. That's the first reason. The second reason is we have probably one of the most phenomenal casts. You know, for a young actor like me to be able to work with the likes of, you know, Dame Judi Dench, Dame Maggie Smith, Bill Nighy, Tom Wilkinson, all these theatre greats like Ronnie Pickup, Penelope Wilton. And it was a real honour and a pleasure. And the director, John Madden, who's directed Shakespeare in Love, was also just a dream to work with. And, you know, it was a chance to go back to a place that I really, you know, fell in love with during Slumdog and, you know, film again, I guess.
Well, it is India-centric, though. And
yeah.
And I think for people who don't know, you didn't grow up in India. You grew up in England.
No, I'm from the UK. Yeah, that's the accent.
Yeah. So really that was my question. Were you at all concerned about being typecast? Because it is another India-centric
project. Yeah, and
project.
He's definitely a loud one. Not really, because, you know, I, more than anything, this is, I think, a real poignant comedy. And most of my decisions are based on gut instinct. You know, I can read half a script and I decide before I've even finished if I'm going to do it or not. And with this one, I definitely knew, without even knowing the amazing cast that was attached, which speaks volumes in itself. But I was like, you know, this is something that I really... It's a character that I can get my teeth into. He's this kind of flamboyant entrepreneur who has this, you know, dream to outsource old age.
Well, he so means well. He is so... dare I say it, adorable. I hope you don't mind.
No, but, I was aiming for that. Annoyingly adorable is what I was aiming for.
Well, tell me more. That was my question, is what were you thinking about when putting this character together? Sonny is, as you can hear from that, just that short clip that you played, he's frantic. He's trying to get the hotel ready. And he doesn't even seem to really realize that he has kind of oversold the thing.
Yes. You know? Yeah, well, he's this kind of mad mess, you know, who is untamed. And for someone like me reading it, I knew I could really have some fun. And, you know, he's ever the optimist. His line he always uses, his go-to line, is everything will be all right in the end. And if it's not all right, then it's not yet the end. And, you know, he kind of uses it in moments as an excuse. You know, when the guests arrive, for instance, he's still trying to paint the building and he's got green paint all over his face when they all arrive. They soon find out that this hotel that they saw in the brochure has actually just been magnificently photoshopped by this kid. And it's just a nightmare, you know, when they get there.
Well, and it's not his only challenge in the film.
Yeah.
He also, and I must say,
there's a little bit of romance.
This is just the second film in which you have like a fabulous love interest. I don't know who
it's
you
in
must
the contract.
Have.
No, I'm
oh,
joking.
Is it? Okay.
No,
I was going to say, I don't know whether the casting gods have been looking out for you.
I do not do a movie unless the woman is stupidly out of my league. My co-star. No, I'm joking. Okay.
So the theme here is he's trying to get his very traditional mother to warm up to his girlfriend, Sunaina, who's played by Tina Desai.
Yes.
And let's play a short clip for about a scene between the two of them here.
Oh, God. Here we go.
Do you love me, Sunny?
My feelings for you cannot be reduced to a single word.
It's a nice word. People like hearing it.
You know, it will be easier to talk to my mother when the hotel is a success.
And what if it isn't?
Everything will be all right in the end. And if it is not all right, then it is not yet the end.
Sunny.
It will succeed. It has to.
Because then you can stand up to your family.
Because then I can stand next to you.
All together now. Aww.
That's going to spoil my street cred, that one. Damn.
No. If it hasn't been already. Well, sorry. But... You know, but let me just talk about this. The scenario there is not unique to India, okay, in the sense of a young person is drawn to someone who his parents do not approve of for whatever reason. I mean, that seems to be kind of a universal theme. But it is interesting sort of in the context of, I think, you know, modern India, where there does seem to be this pull between tradition and...
Definitely,
you know, modernity.
Definitely.
You just talk a little bit about how you saw that relationship.
Well, it's great because in Slumdog, I'm obviously playing a character that's on a whole different spectrum of society. Sonny, the character I play in this show, in this movie, he comes from wealth and he has this background of these brothers who are all doing fantastically well and, you know, doing his parents proud. And he's this one boy who is kind of gone askew, you know, and straight. And, you know, he falls in love with this girl who's kind of wild one. And his mother is... completely disapproving, and he's really not manned up to the situation and actually introduced them properly. And they meet, I don't want to give too much away, but they meet in the worst scenario possible for your mother to kind of find your girlfriend and be introduced, and everything just goes wrong from there.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News, and I'm speaking with actor Dev Patel. You know him from Slumdog Millionaire fame. We're talking about his new movie, The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. It opens today in select U.S. theaters. You mentioned earlier that this was a great opportunity for you to work with, in this country, known primarily as Oscar winners, Judi Dench and Maggie Smith, Oscar nominee Tom Wilkinson. What was that like, working with them? Was it intimidating?
Auditioning was great. And then as soon as I got the call saying that I'd been awarded this role, the nerves immediately kicked in. And, you know, the week before I flew out to India to meet everyone and shoot and rehearse, it literally was the most terrifying moment of my entire life because, you know, they've been acting since I was a fetus. I don't know. I mean, they've just been around for so long and they've seen it all. And I'm like, what have I got to offer? And all these kind of, you know, things run through your brain. But as soon as I flew out and met them all in India, you know, I've never, and this is going to sound so cliche and tacky, but literally they're the coolest bunch of people I've ever met. It was good fun.
Well, congratulations on everything that you've achieved so far. I did want to ask before we let you go, you know, both of your previous films, Slumdog Millionaire and The Last Airbender, kind of sparked conversations apart from the films. In Slumdog, as I'm sure you know, there was all kinds of conversation about filmmaker Danny Boyle, whether he had done enough to kind of give back in the wake of the success of the film. And then in The Last Airbender, that was criticized by a lot of fans of the original animated series Avatar, because the characters in that original story were Asian, and the only Asian actor cast in a major role was you. Then you played a villain. And I'm just wondering your thoughts on both of those controversies.
On both of those. To start off with Slumdog, it was an incredibly tricky situation because, you know, we had this filmmaker who wanted to make a kind of movie that would open eyes around the world, and he wanted it to be as authentic as possible. I think the important thing that a lot of people need to understand is, you know, when you grow up in a place like a slum in Mumbai, the essential thing to give these children is actually the gift of education. So we'd set up this kind of thing where Danny had and a few of the people on the film set had kind of taken it on their hands to find an English-speaking school to put these children into. And the idea was they could only access their fund when they were 18 and they'd stayed in the school to be educated. And obviously, when you're doing a movie that's so big, there's this massive magnification lens put on it, and everyone's trying to find a kind of chink in the armor, I guess, of this kind of big movie, you know, which is sad because, you know, in this case, they went to crazy extents, you know, to kind of do this.
What about The Last Airbender?
Oh, The Last Airbender. I was a massive fan of this cartoon, and I signed on to do this movie, and I've been doing martial arts for 8 years. A little note for you there. You know, it made me realize when you're doing these big films, you become really small in the process of this, you know, this big mechanical machine, this studio movie. My character, the so-called villain in the first episode, goes on to be the kind of hero of the show, and he's kind of the fan favorite. So for me, it actually was the coolest role to play, you know, this kind of kid who could throw fire out of his hands and things.
Well, who doesn't want to throw fire?
Exactly. It's every like, I was like, I don't know how old I was. I was 18. I was like, every 18-year-old's dream to play a role like that.
Well, what do you hope people will get out of The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel?
I think it's a story about living life at any age. You know, it's a group of retirees that get thrown into one of the most extreme environments in the world. And, you know, some of them are done with learning and experiencing, and they put up these bars and they're kind of swallowed alive by this crazy environment, which is India. And the others kind of are open and willing to experience. And it's a really great story about cherishing life and seeing that, you know, it's worth living at any age, you know.
Well, congratulations to you on all your success. Come back and see us.
I will do.
Dev Patel is an actor. His latest film is The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel. It opens in select U.S. theaters today. And we caught up with him at our NPR West studios in Culver City, California. Dev Patel, thank you so much for speaking with us.
That's cool. It's a pleasure.